The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Greetings, friends. Welcome to Critically Acclaimed, the film review podcast where good taste and bad taste collide. Thank you for mixing that in, William.
You're welcome.
My name is Whitney Seibold. I'm a film critic. I write for Slash Film. I don't have a cute nickname, but my scintillating and far more intelligent co-host with much better taste than me, William, he does. So, William, why don't you introduce yourself?
Why does he always do that? My name is William Bibbiani. I am a critic. Everybody calls me Bibbs. I write for The Wrap and Slash Film. And I also co-host this podcast with Whitney, who is smarter than me, more handsome, has a fuller beard. I love him to pieces, really.
I think you just need to shape your beard. You like to have sort of like a wide beard. Mm. It kind of like sweeps outwards.
I'm going for sort of a Zeus kind of look.
Yeah. But whereas I try to keep mine sort of closely trimmed. It's just the looks we've chosen for ourselves.
Sure.
One is not better than the other.
I think one is. But anyway, this is our podcast where we review the cinema. Hmm. And this week on Critically Acclaimed, we're going to be reviewing the new releases, Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse, The Boogeyman, Follow Her, and Shooting Stars.
One of the many, many, many movies called Shooting Stars. Mm. I remember there was one year where a movie called Lucky came out. It was really good. And then the next year, a movie called Lucky came out, and it was really, really good.
Yeah.
I mean,
in 2009, I think there were like four movies that came out with a title of that was either, there was Nine, The Nine.
The Nines, plural.
District Nine.
District Nine, a lot of nines that year.
Very confusing. Unnecessarily so, really.
And usually that sort of thing is just a coincidence. Like, people are working on these movies at different times, and they just happen to fall at the same time. Yeah. No secondary movies about Spider-Man this year, as far as I can tell.
No, probably not. Secondary movies about Spider-Man.
The world is... I think we're going to start with Spider-Man, because that's like...
It's the big release.
It's the big release.
We usually start with the biggest, widest release.
I believe this is the, all told, the 15th feature film about Spider-Man, if you count the TV movies.
Yeah, that's a question. So in the 1970s, there was a live-action Spider-Man television series starring Nicholas Hammond as Peter Parker. The first episode of that was what we call a backdoor pilot, which means that if we decide not to pick this up, the pilot can be reused as a movie.
Yeah,
and that movie was released in theaters overseas.
Which happened a lot in the 70s. A lot of TV movies that you think of as just TV movies in North America were theatrical releases, usually in Europe.
Yeah, and then there was, after that, there were two more movies starring Nicholas Hammond that were repurposed episodes of the shows, two-parters that were then re-edited together, and again, released overseas as a theatrical film. The first one, or rather the second one, was called Spider-Man Strikes Back. And then the third one was like Spider-Man, the Dragon's Lair or something like that. I'm going to look that up, actually.
But there were three of them.
There were three of those. There was also, in the 1970s, concurrently with the Nicholas Hammond series, which was actually relatively popular, but the network wasn't super interested in being the superhero network, because they already had Wonder Woman and Incredible Hulk, and they were afraid they were chasing too young an audience, which is a weird thing.
Well, you know, the kids just grew up and didn't put down their toys, so now it's an adult audience, but it wasn't at the time.
Yeah, overseas, in Japan, there was a live-action Spider-Man series in which... And this was the first kind of series to popularize this concept. There was a regular, you know, human hero. Occasionally he put on his superhero costume. And then in the last third of the episode, he would call forth his giant robot to fight a giant monster. This is the exact mold that Mighty Morphin Power Rangers would later popularize all over the world. But in the late 1970s, that was Spider-Man.
Spider-Man did that.
However,
I've seen a little bit of the Japanese Spider-Man TV series, and it is amazing.
It's bizarre. It's wonderful. And there was a feature-length version movie of that.
Oh, I didn't know about that movie. I knew about the series.
That one, I've actually never seen that one. That one, I'm not 100% sure if that was, you know, episodes repurposed or if it's own special thing, because I haven't seen that one.
That TV series was licensed by Marvel,
Totally official.
In fact, I think Stan Lee is even credited as, like, not just executive producer, he was like a creative consultant.
He wanted that to happen. That was a big idea.
All of these ideas, it's like, yeah, let's just do Spider-Man in this sort of tokusatsu mold. We'll have the Japanese version of it. Yeah. So that's just as official as anything you might have seen, you know, on Saturday mornings in the 1990s.
Mm-hmm. However, unofficially, the other Spider-Man movie was Spider-Man The Dragon's Challenge.
The Dragon's Challenge.
Different thing. Right. Before any of that, there was an unofficial Spider-Man movie.
Oh, there was like a fan movie. Was this the one about the fellow who actually swung on cables off of actual buildings and filmed himself doing it?
No. I'm not talking about that. That's awesome, though. I'm talking about the feature film made, again, overseas, in Turkey.
Oh.
Called Three Dev Adam, or Three Giant Men.
I don't know the Turkish word for three, but it's... If you want to say it in Turkish, you would have to
fair enough.
Word for three, but yeah.
Touche. And that movie, if you've never seen that movie is a trip, because that movie is an unofficial... in Turkey, they were making a lot of unofficial genre intellectual property movies. There was a Turkish Star Trek, a Turkish Star Wars, etc.
And they just used the names.
Yeah,
I've seen Turkish Rambo. I've seen Turkish Star Wars.
I've seen Three Dev Adam.
Turkish E.T. is a trip.
Weird film.
There's also... The other Turkish E.T.
It's a lot of those.
One Turkish E.T. ripped off the other one. It's pretty kooky.
And the thing is, these movies were never intended to be seen outside of Turkey. They didn't care about breaking someone's copyright because no one's ever going to see it, right? Then the internet gets invented and bootlegs get invented before that. Three Dev Adam is a superhero team-up movie in which Captain America and El Santo, the luchador superhero... not played by the real El Santo, unfortunately, but because El Santo is an actual guy. They team up to fight a counterfeiting, mass-murdering Spider-Man who can also clone himself. And this predates the part that's the bits in the comic where Spider-Man got cloned. So maybe it's more official than we realize.
Here's something fun about the clone saga. I read Spider-Man comics as a teenager.
Sure.
Which was in the 1990s, which I only learned in retrospect was the worst time to be reading comics. you talk to like comic book scholars and people who have been following these stories for a long time. The time when I was collecting is like the low point. High point in sales, low point in story.
And that's why, because what they were doing was people had started realizing that comic books like could be big money if you collected them and protected them. And so what they would do is they would release one giant event comic after another, the death of Superman. And what you'd have to do is you'd have to buy it twice.
One was in the polyurethane bag.
So you had to keep it in the bag forever so that would retain its value. Mm. And then you had to buy another one so you could actually open it and read it. This was true for X-Force comics because each one was packaged with a different trading card with different characters.
That was an X-Men crossover event. The Executioner's Song, which X-Men, but it was also X-Force and Uncanny X-Men.
Well, X-Force at number one was the one that was packaged with individual trading cards. I had one issue for each trading card and an issue to open.
But here's the problem. So you bought like 10 copies of the same
card. Exactly. Yeah. And of course I was being scammed. And the problem with that, first off, is that they were putting more care into creating an event than they were into actually writing good comics. Some of them were good. A lot of them weren't. The other problem was... The reason why Action Comics #1 was selling for the numbers it was selling as was because there was a little thing called scarcity. If you print a million of them, no one's going to spend $1 million on that comic. And people realized this pretty quickly, and then the bottom fell out of that market, and it was a whole thing.
Yeah. That was me. That's the ethos I grew up with when reading comics.
Does it have a hologram on the cover? Yeah. I'm in.
I was sucker enough to do that a few times. Mm. Like, I bought it because it was a #1. And there were a lot of new characters and new #1s. They rebooted series. They introduced new series.
New costumes. This is an important issue. Make sure you get this one. Batman has a new costume.
I bought an X-Force comic because it was one where they had new costumes. I didn't really care that much about X-Force. But I also got Iron Man number 300. I wasn't a fan of Iron Man, but sure. I liked the gold boss, gold stamping on it.
That was a cool looking cover.
They would emboss covers, they would stamp them, and they started to make fun of this after a while when they spun off the Ren and Stimpy show into a comic book.
Yeah.
Marvel Comics did that.
Yeah.
They put it in the bag, and the bag was only partly opaque. There was like a little window, a clear window in the bag, so you could see through to a drawing. But once you opened it, you saw the speech bubble that was hidden that said, "You idiot, you opened the bag. The comic is worthless." So that was really cute.
And that's actually a fun tie-in because the Ren and Stimpy comic was often, I don't know if it was exclusively, but a lot of them were written by a writer named Dan Slott.
Mm.
Dan Slott would go on to become, many years later, the regular writer of Spider-Man. I think right now he has written more issues of Spider-Man than any other writer in history.
Yeah, he's the Spider-Man guy.
And
one of the Spider-Man guys.
And it was his storyline that gave birth to the idea of the, quote, Spider-Verse, in which every different version of Spider-Man that ever existed, alternate realities that we've seen, cartoon shows, movies, stuff that we've never seen that he just pulled out of his butt because it was a funny idea, put them all together in one comic. That was a Dan Slott, and the artists involved as well, but that was Dan Slott. And then, of course, in the interim, we had the Tobey Maguire movies, we had the Andrew Garfield movies, and we have the Tom Holland movies.
Yeah.
And then we had the animated movie Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, which was the first big superhero multiverse movie.
Yeah, and Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse came in like a freight train.
Yeah.
It was so striking and moving and dazzling in terms of its animation, in terms of its style.
Mm-hmm.
It had characters that were drawn in different styles in the same frame. There was a Spider-Man noir that was in black and white and shaded differently than the other characters.
Mm-hmm. There was an anime
character.
Yep.
And all of these characters lived in the same frame together. And what it pointed out was something... first of all, it kind of, in a very clever kind of a way, tackled the idea of canon.
Yeah.
I think it understood that a lot of comic book nerds were out there debating who really counts as the real Spider-Man.
Yeah, you're not a Spider-Man fan because you're not a fan of the real Spider-Man.
Whatever.
You only like Miles Morales. You don't like Peter Parker is the real Spider-Man.
Yeah, but which Peter Parker? There's all these different versions of him. So what the Spider-Verse said is, well, you know, if all of these Spider-Men exist and they're all sort of heroes in their own universes. Mm-hmm. Then they're just all Spider-Man, and that's fine.
They're all equally
heroic,
yeah.
And if you like the story of this hero, then you like the story of a hero, and the heroism is the important thing.
Yeah,
and it was also really funny, and it was really strange, and
the soundtrack is fantastic.
And the animators kind of remembered that animation is a limitless medium.
Mm-hmm.
You can do whatever you want with it. You can have little words appearing on the screen. You can show whatever angles you want. You can turn the background into whatever wash of color you need to for the scene. It was this canny blend of cinema and comics. It almost felt like a new medium was being invented.
There's a moment in Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. It's a little moment. Mm. It's not a big moment.
Into or across?
Into.
All right.
That is one of my favorite just incidental moments. Little detail. You might not even notice it the first time you watch it.
Yeah.
But this is just so charming to me.
Okay.
That even if the rest of the movie was terrible, I would love it. There's a bit where Spider-Man and Spider-Man, the sort of down on his luck Peter Parker and Miles Morales learning to be Spider-Man, they're in a lab, they're trying to get some information about the Big MacGuffin, or the Goober, as they call it in that. it's always a Goober.
Uh-huh.
They have to run out of the building, they run through the mess hall, Spider-Man throws a bagel at a guy, it hits him in the head, and you see right outside of his head, as it hits his head, bagel.
Yeah.
It says bagel in letters. And I love that.
Mm.
And there's actually a shout out to that in the new movie, and it makes me really happy.
Oh, I didn't catch that.
It's adorable. I'll tell you later, but it's not important. It's just cute. That movie is fantastic. That movie was critically acclaimed. That movie won the Academy Award for Best Animated Feature. And weirdly enough, lowest grossing Spider-Man movie.
Yeah, I think there was still just sort of because Spider-Man was concurrently also being introduced to the Marvel Cinematic Universe, part of the Avengers series, and I think a lot of audiences preferred like that as the, quote, official version of Spider-Man,
I think,
as opposed to these animated versions, which were arguing openly they're all valid.
And that's my thing. I think what happened is, I honestly think that there was a tendency, and this new movie is making a lot of money, so I think, I have a theory about that, but when Into the Spider-Verse came out, it still felt like there are the real superhero movies, and then there's this animated movie.
And there's, we don't still animate superhero movies. They're mostly animated anyway, but yeah.
There's a stigma
in
Western culture in particular, where an animated movie is for children. Mm-hmm. Not even teenagers. Children. It's not a four-quadrant movie. I think Into the Spider-Verse came out. Not everyone saw it in theaters. It did well, but it didn't break the bank. It was popular enough and acclaimed enough to get a sequel. And enough people finally saw it on like home video and streaming that the sequel is now a huge monster. And this happened
That happens a lot with where an original movie doesn't get acclaim until the sequel comes. I remember that when that happened with Austin Powers.
The first one was not a huge hit. It did okay.
But it found its audience on home video. Exactly. People rented it from Blockbuster.
Terminator 2 was a much bigger monster hit than Terminator 1.
Terminator is a great example.
X-Men 1 did okay. X-2, X-Men United, was huge. Batman Begins, modest hit. The Dark Knight, one of the biggest movies of all time. I have a theory. And as with all of these kinds of theories, especially ones that have to do with box office, there's a lot of X factors, a lot of nebulous elements. When it comes to sequels and the box office success of sequels, the box office success of a sequel, especially opening weekend, often has a lot more to do with how much people liked the previous film.
Yeah. Well, look at something like another superhero movie. Iron Man 3.
Yeah.
Opened to ginormous numbers. It was, I think it made like $175 million its opening weekend. Like almost as big as the Avengers.
Right.
Because it was the first Avengers movie after the Avengers.
Yeah, exactly.
So people were high on the Avengers. It's like, we want to see more of that. And then it kind of fell off, and now it's sort of regarded as like not as good as, so,
some
as
people,
all that.
Some people aren't a huge fan.
It's one of my favorites.
I think it's great.
So I understand why something like Across the Spider-Verse would be a big hit. Part of me is a little upset that the filmmakers went with a Spider-Man sequel instead of taking their clout that they earned with this and doing something kind of even more striking and original rather than staying with the same characters.
Like moving away from any IP?
Yeah, no IP. Just something entirely new. Don't get me to like a new Spider-Man. Get me to like something entirely different. But everything I said about Into the Spider-Verse and all of its sort of striking gorgeousness and interesting ideas, double it. Because that's Across the Spider-Verse.
It's huge. It's
much, much longer for one, but not in a way that bothers me.
No, it's paced great, honestly.
It's paced great. I think it's incredibly overwritten, but we'll get to that. But in terms of like going even further with the animated style, good God, this thing is like pouring rainbows directly into your eyes in the most pleasant possible way.
It opens with this like really beautifully expressionistic bit of Gwen Stacy, Spider-Gwen, who we met in the previous film, the version of Spider-Man where
she calls herself Spider-Woman. She doesn't give away her the audience secret
knows
identity,
her as Spider-Gwen. It's kind of, it's like that one old cartoon, Super President. I wonder who he could be. He's the president, but he's a superhero.
There's a joke.
The show sucks.
There's a Tiny Toon Adventures joke. Babs Bunny. She has a superhero identity, and she's Super Babs.
Yeah.
And at the end, it's like, she's flying off, and she doesn't wear a mask. She just looks the same, and all of her friends who know her says, I wonder who she really is.
Yeah.
And Plucky Duck says, well, who do we know named Super?
It's a great joke.
That was a cute joke.
It's a great joke. We see her, and she's just playing drums. She's like in a band, and it's this wonderfully beautiful expressionistic music video. It has nothing to do with the action, really. And it is much more about her emotions and what she's experiencing as a human being. And then that somehow manages to explode into this gigantic action sequence where a supervillain from another reality, a reality that is based entirely on Renaissance artwork, so he looks like he's been pulled out of like parchment.
Sepia tone drawn with brown lines.
He's made out of parchment, and they see that he's made out of parchment. This isn't like, this is actually just what his reality looks like. So now she's fighting a cartoon villain from a completely different universe, and then other Spider-Persons from other realities come in, and they're just like, hey, yeah, you didn't fix the multiverse, it's actually still fucked.
Yeah.
And so we have to, we've been assembling all the Spider-Persons to stop all of these villains who keep popping into the wrong realities and try to fix the problem.
Yeah.
And that's the basic setup for the whole shenanigan.
This is like one of the most aesthetically powerful movies I think I might have ever seen.
I haven't seen like a mainstream movie, even the original Spider-Verse, which I guess is part and parcel with this, like maybe Scott Pilgrim versus the World, in terms of just trying to
everything,
push as far as it can go.
And so like when all of the scenes with Spider-Gwen, like when she's alone, there's a lot more close-ups. Mm-hmm. There's a lot more where she's really sharp, but the background starts to melt away into colors. But then there's other characters who themselves are really raggedy. There's a character we'll meet later on called Spider-Punk.
I love Spider-Punk.
Daniel Kaluuya, and has like a spiked mohawk and a torn denim jacket, and carries a guitar.
It's like
Spider-Man.
It's like if one of the Sex Pistols was bitten by a radioactive spider. That's the idea.
And he pulls off his mask, and somebody says, how are we even cooler without the mask? And the way they animate him is he looks like he's printed on like rumpled punk rock flyers, and he's constantly changing colors throughout the scenes he's in.
As though every single frame he's in was pulled like from like a different magazine that you were making a collage.
Like a zine,
out of.
So
it's amazingly cool.
Yeah. And the main character, Miles Morales, he's sort of the emotional heart of the story. He's played by Shameik Moore. And I think he's just my favorite Spider-Man now.
He's wonderful.
Used to be a fan of Spider-Man until I saw Spider-Man Far From Home, and then I was just done. It's like, this character has nothing for me anymore. The story is not interesting. The character has no personality anymore.
Ironically,
I'm done with Spider-Man.
When I saw Far From Home, I was like, I don't particularly care for this version of Spider-Man. They won me back with No Way Home. I actually really
like
that movie.
I like No Way Home, but I still don't like that version of Spider-Man. I think he's kind of personality free.
But here's the thing. That doesn't mean you don't like Spider-Man, because there's an infinite number of spider people.
I suppose so. I guess if I have a new favorite, it's Miles Morales.
Miles is wonderful.
And he kind of is taking things a little bit back to basics in terms of like street level Spider-Man. He lives in, I think he lives in Brooklyn.
Not 100%.
I think he's Brooklyn. He's New York. And he is dealing with Spider-Man stuff at the beginning of the movie. He needs to get into a new school, but he's late for a meeting because he has a fight with a villain. That's Spider-Man story stuff.
Very classic Spider-Man
stuff. The fight on the way is really innovative because he's fighting a bad guy called The Spot, who has like little portals in his body.
Yeah, so if like you punch him,
your fist will go in, but it'll appear sort of randomly in somewhere else in the frame. And, and that they do a lot of really innovative stuff with the way his body parts are sort of flying around and appearing in different places throughout the fight.
That's so neat.
It's and that's just sort of like a cleverly staged fight scene. But he sees that Spider-Gwen, who is from a different reality than his, has joined this interdimensional cadre of other spider people.
Yeah, she comes to visit him. And it's actually one of the things I love about this movie. As gigantic as it is, it's a maximalist dream. Just everything is extreme and gorgeous. Every scene is trying a different style. There's tons of incredible wild action. And yet, they know to stop and talk. There's
a lot of quiet moments.
There's a great bit after that first fight with the Spot, and Spider-Man ends up teaming up with a cop who just happens to be Miles Morales' dad. And they're just, the Spot's gone, but the crisis has been averted. And they're just waiting for the cops to show up, and they just sort of hang out like, so, how are things going with your son?
Yeah. And it never feels like rushed or contrived, and I appreciate that. It does make the movie longer, but it needs
movie better. It makes the pacing better. So
it also lets you breathe a little bit between all of these like wild colors. If it was like as just aggressively stylish as it is, like during the action sequences throughout, it would be exhausting.
Exactly,
and it knows how to pace.
Exactly, it knows when to just make real character moments, and so we get all these wonderful real character moments between Miles and Gwen, where they talk about how they feel isolated, there are things they can't tell anyone else, they feel connected, we really care about them.
Yeah, there's a wonderful scene where they're sort of sitting on a building, looking out over New York, and having a conversation. He's clearly in love with her, but she doesn't feel the same way, so it's kind of awkward
for him. Or at least it's more complicated,
But because they're spider people, they can sit on the underside of, like, a buttress and look out on the city while they're hanging upside down, and that's because they're spider
it's
people.
Distinct.
That's,
you couldn't get that scene in another movie. But yeah, so it turns out Gwen is there on a Spider-Verse mission. Miles gets pulled into the Spider-Verse. He meets a whole bunch of Spider-Verse people. Turns out the Spot has found a way to travel between dimensions, and he's causing a lot of trouble. I don't want to go into too much further from there.
Well, I'll say this, that he's not like the villain of the piece, but he is an antagonist. Spider-Man 2099.
Yeah. It's a character I loved as a kid.
I love those 2099 comics. They were so wild and stupid and strange.
Yeah, there was basically...
I was a big fan of X-Men 2099, which has nothing to do with the X-Men.
No, it's weird. In the 1990s, there was an offshoot imprint of Marvel, much like the Ultimate... the Ultimate Comics, which is Ultimate Spider-Man, Ultimate X-Men.
Which I think is even too old for a lot of our listeners, as is.
Basically, what happened was, in order to reinvigorate excitement into these characters and the Marvel brand, they would release not one comic, but a whole series of comics that take place in sort of an offshoot area. And the Ultimate Universe, it was basically like, hey, listen, every single one of our superhero comics has hundreds of issues, decades of backstory.
We're rebooting all of your favorite heroes in the present day, essentially.
Yeah, so basically, what if Spider-Man was invented now, and that version became incredibly popular, and that version ended up leading to the creation of Miles Morales, so that's very important. One of the things that they tried in the 90s was Marvel 2099, which was basically, what will the Marvel Universe look like in the year 2099? And the idea is they introduced a whole bunch of legacy heroes. Like, this is what Spider-Man looks like in 2099.
The legacy of these heroes lasted into the future, so new characters... Yeah. Took on the mantle. And so Spider-Man 29, completely different costume, new character, totally different ethos, but he went by the name Spider-Man.
Yeah, we had X-Men 2099, we had Doom 2099, which was actually
Dr. Doom.
Which is actually our Dr. Doom, who time-traveled into the future.
Yeah.
Created a little bit of connective tissue there.
There was a Ghost Rider who was an android.
Yeah, that was a great-looking comic, that one. I honestly don't remember anything that happened in it, but the art was fantastic.
A lot of really cool art. The robot Ghost Rider was just kind of cool-looking.
Ravage?
Yeah, well, I was about to say, the one that Stan Lee, who invented all of this, liked the best, and the one he wrote was Ravage 2099, a new character.
Yeah.
There isn't a Ravage in the present day.
No.
He just liked this sort of, like, future vigilante, like, tough guy vigilante.
It was basically a tough guy vigilante who lived in a junkyard, and he would take everyone's refuse and turn it into something... heroic and positive,
So, cool idea.
Yeah.
And eventually he became he got infected with monster blood or something, and he grew, like, horns out of his face and became...
I didn't stick around that far.
2099. So, Spider-Man 2099 is kind of the antagonist of Across the Spider-Verse, and he is essentially in charge of the interdimensional spider cadre.
Yeah.
And he has a very specific mission in mind, and it's to protect spider people. From whatever dimension they happen to be.
Because when you're a spider person, you know, they're very, very different. There are spider cowboys, spider cars that are, like, sentient, like from the Cars universe.
We already met Spider-Ham in the last movie, so...
The spider car, by the way,
No Spider-Ham in this one, by the way. I think he has, like, a cameo. It's like that's frustrating because I liked Spider-Ham.
I wanted more of the car. The car's name is Peter Parked Car, the Amazing Spider-Mobile. More, please. I love that.
I love that they're not afraid to go to really silly places. There's cameos from, like, the 1960s animated Spider-Man shows up in that style in one scene.
And a bunch of other versions as well.
I was going to mention, because I was collecting comics in the 90s, I'm very familiar with the Clone Saga, where Spider-Man was cloned. Terrifically unpopular now. Really high selling at the time.
Oh, yeah.
Spider-Man was cloned. It was this villain called the Jackal was creating Spider-Man clones to create mischief. And, and one of the... Back in the 70s, Spider-Man was cloned, and that clone was thought to be dead, but he survived, and he came back and took Spider-Man's place.
Well, the idea initially was we were going to, like, listen, we're both clones of each other. We should probably do a scientific test to find out which one of us is the original. Mm-hmm. And the big twist was the Spider-Man that we, the audience, had been following since the 1970s, that had been the clone,
the whole time.
And he agreed to let the clone, who had been living...
Take over.
Like, you know what? I've been Peter Parker for years.
There's a miniseries called Spider-Man The Lost Years. And it was about what had happened in those 20 years.
So that version of Spider-Man, the Scarlet Spider shows up, and he's great.
And I was fond of the Scarlet Spider. Although in this version, they changed the character to be like, I'm Broody's 90s guy. He's leaning up against a wall. Hey, how you doing? I'm just thinking about my past. Oh, that was a hard memory. Like, he wasn't like that in the comics.
I think he's voiced by Andy Samberg.
It's Andy Samberg, so it's played for laughs.
Yeah. The idea is you're not just getting spider powers. There are distinct parallels in your life, and they might take slightly different forms. But basically, some of these things need to happen. Mm. Or else all of reality will crumble. Yeah, it's like any sort of time travel movie where it's like, we can futz around a little bit, but there are certain things that can't change, or else all of reality will be destroyed. We can't we can't prevent Mount Vesuvius from erupting, to borrow a Doctor Who reference.
Yeah, the Spider-Man origin story is incredibly fatalistic, especially when you're dealing with hundreds of spider people.
Yeah.
That means hundreds of Uncle Bens have to die at some point, or his equivalent.
Yeah.
And Miles Morales looked at that, and this is where the moral center of the film comes in, and says, why do we have to let all those people die?
Yeah.
We're here. Great power comes great responsibility. Let's just save them.
Yeah.
And Spider-Man 2099 says no. And that's kind of... And
that's...
So it sort of introduces this theme of anti-fatalism, where it's about free will. It's about choosing your own path. The major issue I have with the movie... And I don't have many issues. I want to say right away, I love this movie.
Yeah, movie's amazing.
I think it's really, really great. I think I like the original better.
Yeah.
My big issue with this movie is that it doesn't conclude.
Yeah, it's got a cliffhanger.
It's not just a cliffhanger. It introduces an idea right near the end that doesn't just recontextualize or leave you on some sort of action hangover. Cliffhanger, hangover. I'm fine with cliffhangers. We just had one with Fast X.
Yeah.
Which... I mean, that is such a clunky, corny kind of action serial movie. Ending it on a cliffhanger is totally appropriate for a movie like Fast X.
Sure.
And I love where we left off with Fast X. How is he going to get out of this one? That's the big question. It's not that kind of cliffhanger with Across the Spider-Verse. It's something that actually introduces an element that contradicts the theme that was introduced earlier.
Oh.
And there needed to be a line of dialogue or an action scene or something where we could actually have a little bit better of a counterpoint rather than this hastily introduced idea. And I can't say what it is without giving it away.
We don't want to spoil it. That would be a proper spoiler. Ruin the movie.
It would kind of spoil the movie. But they introduced this idea at the end of the movie that is actually very pro-fatalistic. And the movie ends right there having said both things without really had the two ideas... interact with each other, and that kind of thematic cutoff makes me feel like I haven't finished the movie yet.
Well,
and
you haven't.
There's another one coming, Spider-Man Beyond the Spider-Verse is coming in March.
Yeah,
And
work faster!
And
I want it sooner,
so I'm reminded very much of The Matrix Reloaded, in that, because The Matrix was very striking, very good, and then it had these two gigantic... it was like a two-part...
By the way, I'm sorry, but we've got someone... The pipes in my building are really loud right now. If you hear weird background noise, that'll be over in a minute.
That's not your apartment, it's ours. In The Matrix Reloaded, there was... It's like a two-part mega-sequel, Reloaded and Revolutions. It wasn't like a trilogy. It was like one movie and then a two-part movie... Second movie.
Yeah, well, kind of three, because the Animatrix was before that. And it really gave you a lot of relevant information.
I guess so, the Animatrix as well. But so I feel like... And The Matrix Reloaded also ended with this really intriguing idea.
Yeah.
And spoils for The Matrix Reloaded.
It's like 20-year-old movie at this point.
So in the original Matrix, it was about how they discovered they were humanity was being held in pods in the distant future by this malevolent machine intelligence that was sucking off of their brains.
We were trapped in a virtual reality.
So the reality we're experiencing is virtual, fed to us by a machine, and humanity wanted to escape that. They wanted to get out into the pods and take back the Earth. And Keanu Reeves was so good at manipulating computers. He was such a talented hacker that he was able to essentially give himself superpowers in The Matrix. And he became sort of this messiah figure. The first movie ended really great. We didn't need sequels.
It was a pretty good standalone. It left it open-ended, but it could have been its own thing. Yeah.
And then they did this hugely overblown sequel where it's overplotted now. There's way too much going on.
I will say this. I rewatched them a year ago. Reloaded actually kills. Reloaded is pretty great.
Well, and there's like that gigantic fight sequence on the freeway. They built a freeway to do it.
Yeah, that bit's amazing.
There's these weird twin characters that can turn into ghosts. There's all these new elements in here.
Yeah.
And it's all dazzling to look at.
Yeah.
But it becomes too much of a muchness after a while. And then they introduced this idea right at the end where they said, I'm going to talk to this computer intelligence. Looks exactly like Sigmund Freud. And
it's building up to, we got to get in here, action, explosions, get in here. And then long conversation where we do a lot of exposition.
A lot of exposition.
And explain what the Matrix really is. And we explain
that... He explains that the reason this Messiah figure, Keanu Reeves, was able to do what he did is because the machines allowed it to happen.
Yeah.
This is actually not the first time there's been a human Messiah. They do this every once in a while because they know humans like to rebel and they need that as part of their makeup. Yeah,
so it's like a release valve. Yeah. You know, like every once in a while we let this happen enough, let them get it out of their systems, and then we go back to the way things were.
Cool, intriguing idea.
Yes.
Not followed through in the sequel.
No, very frustrating. The sequel, The Matrix Revolutions.
Revolutions was the third, second part of the second one.
There's some neat ideas in Revolutions, and, you know, the idea is that Neo is given a binary choice. He's chosen to, you can either continue on with, you know, your revolution, and it's just going to end the exact same way, or you can join us right now and we'll just restart everything and everything will be great. Mm. And he was like, no, I choose a non-binary option. Remember how queer these movies are? It was
maybe trans filmmakers.
Yeah. The final film takes place almost entirely outside of the Matrix, which I feel is a bit of a miscalculation. Because it's just not that interesting a world that you've introduced outside of the Matrix. But there's still some neat ideas in it. Here's why I disagree with you with this.
Let me connect it back to...
Then I want to...
Well, I guess I said it already. The idea that they've introduced this intriguing idea, I wish that they had sort of engaged with that more in Matrix Reloaded.
Sure.
Instead, we had to wait for the sequel, and then the sequel let me down.
Well...
Now, I feel like with Across the Spider-Verse, they introduced all these ideas, and then they introduced this kind of new thematic twist, which it isn't like a... It's a counterpoint, but it's not something that anybody has any chance to sort of react to or come to a conclusion over.
Right.
It's like, so is this fatalistic or not? And I don't know where
in a Schrodinger's cat situation.
Yeah,
the movie
exists. It's simultaneously alive and dead, and
the third
I'm
movie
frustrated
exists, and we're
because
waiting to find out.
Because when like the story concludes and then there's a cliffhanger, I'm okay with it. Look at something like The Empire Strikes Back. Mm-hmm. Like that at least felt like it concluded.
Right.
It left us in sort of a little bit of a like up in the air in terms of like plot.
But yeah, Luke makes a meaningful choice, multiple meaningful choices. We have a big revelation about his relationship to Darth Vader, and then there's a promise: we will find Han Solo, even though we know exactly where he is because everyone knows where Jabba the Hutt is. He's one of the most famous people on the planet. Luke grew up on that planet, a few miles away from where Jabba the Hutt lives. It should not have taken multiple years.
Well, but it also, in terms of like tone and pacing, it's like, and at the end, it's like, I just learned something really terrible.
Yeah.
And it could have just said, and, you know, left on sort of a sad ending. It's like everybody gets taken away and that's it. We didn't necessarily need additional films.
True.
I feel like and this is my only bone with Across the Spider-Verse.
I'm waiting for my turn.
It's okay. Just, I feel like it didn't have that. It didn't have this sense of conclusion.
Right.
Even for a cliffhanger ending. Yeah. It felt incomplete, and that's an issue for me.
Here's why I disagree with the last 10 minutes of what you said.
Okay, thank you.
Thank
you for letting me get it out.
No, and it's a fair cop because of this, if nothing else. It is a cliffhanger ending.
Mm.
And it's not a cliffhanger ending like we would get like in a lot of Marvel movies where it's actually a pretty satisfying done-in-one story, but then there's a little bit at the end where it's like, hey, whatever happened to blank? Or, oh, what's this hammer doing here? Those aren't cliffhangers. Those are sequel teases.
Yeah.
It's not the same thing. A cliffhanger is a story or plot element that is unresolved. And you cannot get that conclusion within the narrative you're seeing now. You have to come back.
Mm.
That's a proper cliffhanger, and this movie does that. I would argue more than Empire Strikes Back does that, because you're right. It resolves it. Is it a happy resolution? No. But the story does come to a conclusion. It doesn't just stop. Fast X stops. Across the Spider-Verse stops. Where I disagree with you, and it's not even the obvious thing where there's another movie coming out and we'll find out when Beyond the Spider-Verse comes out whether they explore all these things to our satisfaction. Maybe they will, and then it'll be great. And maybe they won't, and it'll be kind of a bummer, and it'll be like a Last Jedi kind of thing, where it's like, oh, this movie introduced so many cool things, and the next movie
undoes it a lot,
And now I have to, unfortunately, like the previous movie a little less, because I know those didn't go anywhere, and that's a bummer. But that's neither here nor there. We just have to deal with the movie that we've got for right now, and in 6-8 months, whatever it is, we'll find out how we feel about the whole trilogy. But where I disagree with you is this. I believe that the ending that we get in Across the Spider-Verse It introduces a new element. I believe that element is thematically appropriate based on conversations that we had had. It just doesn't start them anew. Can't really get into that without getting into spoilers. Suffice it to say that thematically what Miles Morales represents, I think, is supported but no longer cut and dry. And as for a conclusion, the film feels complete. I think it does feel complete. I think another character's story, which is introduced in the very first scene in the movie, that comes to a proper narrative character arc conclusion.
That part does.
And I think that gives the movie a sense of a proper chapter has been concluded. They're all spider people. It doesn't have to be just about Miles Morales. I think that gives the movie a sense of some conclusion, even though, obviously, we're still in the middle of the action.
Okay. And so that I'm fine with. That part's fair.
We talk about this a lot, how sometimes action movies will bring the character arc to a conclusion before the action concludes. Here, they're doing both. We're bringing one character's arc to a conclusion, and then the action will continue in the next series, but another character arc has not concluded, and that will carry us through, theoretically.
There was a wonderful way they could have ended on sort of a cliffhanger, where we save a lot of those moments for the following film.
Sure.
The Spider-Gwen conclusion could have been saved for the following film, and there's a scene where Miles, like, finds himself in a certain place. I feel like all of that could have been saved for the following film as well. That would have been kind of a good way to start it.
I disagree, but again, it's hard to talk about it right now. Yeah. Because the movie's good enough that I don't want to, like, ruin these cool moments.
Yeah, so I feel like a lot of people are willing to give that sort of thing a miss, or a pass, rather, just because it's so visually dazzling. It's so exciting to watch. We didn't even mention Mumbatan, Mumbai, Manhattan, where they meet Spider-Man India.
Yeah, that's a cool bit right there.
Yeah, there's just a lot of really cool stuff going on, lot of really great visual stuff. I feel like, though, it starts to, after a while, rather unfortunately, feel a little bit like too many modern blockbusters. It's a movie that is purporting to be, and visually, so much different from everything we've seen before.
Right.
I mentioned that, it feels like a new medium is being invented. And at the same time, like a sequel tease and a certain kind of blockbuster structure where we see everything rather than, like, cutting to the chase, makes it feel like they've had so many good ideas that we're just seeing the director's cut. I felt that way about The Batman as well.
I agree with you on The Batman. That's a different vibe.
It's a lot, not nearly as bad in something like Across the Spider-Verse, but I started to get little flavor, like little whiffs of it. And when I got that smell, it was disappointing.
Well, I hear,
which is a weird thing to say about this movie.
Sorry, I just want to talk about stuff we can't talk about.
For instance, starting with Spider-Gwen and getting her entire story arc, I feel like in a different kind of movie, that part would have been cut out probably, right?
Yeah, probably.
And I like that we got it all.
Yeah, me too.
And I like that they were able to sort of work it in and pace it well, but at the same time, it starts to feel like the story is trying to spread itself out a little bit too far.
No, I don't think so at all. And again, it's the idea that it is spread out is the point. One of the things that I love about this movie, and we talked about how... Miguel O'Hara, Spider-Man 2099, voiced by Oscar Isaac. He is trying to rigidly enforce the idea that Spider-Man people have to have an element of personal tragedy and sacrifice in order to become Spider people. Otherwise, the universe is at stake. And that is a literalization of a literary concept.
Yeah.
The hero's journey. This needs to happen.
And I think it's also a criticism of a lot of modern media discussions.
Bingo! And that's my point. Okay. This is trying to point out that by rigidly following formula, not only do stories become dogmatic, but characters do as well. It becomes fatalistic. It becomes something that must be done simply because it must be done.
And the idea that's the way you make these things.
And the idea of this movie is that it is attempting to challenge that, but it is doing that within a universe that is desperately trying to maintain the formula.
And
to break out of it requires effort.
And I think
that's incorporated there, and I think the fact that there is some of that formula in place is part of the oppressive atmosphere.
I think
that works.
And I appreciate that part. I think that's actually really clever, and I think that Spider-Man 2099 calls that fatalism canon
yeah.
is incredibly telling.
Yeah.
He wants to stick to comic book canon.
Yeah.
That's the way nerds talk, isn't it? Exactly. They're really kind of flying in the face of that. And I like all of that, and I like sort of the conclusion of that and what Miles and Spider-Man 2099 have to say about that. And it was really, really cool. But then it comes to that end, that non-ending.
I don't think it's a non-ending.
I love that ending. And it undoes that conversation that they had earlier in the film.
I don't think it does. I actually think it supports it in a really
interesting
way.
I think it does.
And I want to talk about that. You know what? We're going to talk about this off mic. And I'm going to share a thought I have with you about that. But in any case, it's a theory about like where I think the narrative is going in a way that would justify that.
Okay.
But we'll find out. And this is my thing. I feel... It's frustrating to watch a movie that is not just like ending on a sequel tease, but feels like the first half of something. And we're not going to know how the story actually works until we see the proper conclusion. Because everything I like about this movie could, potentially, when it's recontextualized with the next film, be turned into utter dog shit.
Yeah.
For all I know, I put a lot of faith in it. They made two great movies, but we don't know until we've seen it. It is a Schrodinger's cat situation.
Mm.
And I have been let down before. Not just by, you know, Star Wars, which at least had two different filmmakers, but something like Lars von Trier's Nymphomaniac, which had a brilliant first half, had a mostly brilliant second half, and then the last, like...
5 minutes.
No, not even 5 minutes. The last, like, 60 seconds of that movie.
Like undoes everything.
the entire fucking thing. And now this first half, which I thought was really interesting and daring and challenging and fascinating and full of great character work, now becomes in service of a shit ending that retroactively ruins everything that came before. And that sucks. Yeah, and so like, I'm not...
I want to encourage people to watch all of Nymphomaniac, all 5 hours of it, and turn it off when the sun comes up. There's a scene right near the end where they see the sunrise. Turn it off. You've seen the best version of that movie.
Yeah, when Stellan Skarsgård leaves a room, you're good. Done.
Stellan Skarsgård is going to leave a room.
Stop.
Literally just turn the movie
right
off.
There. Yeah, it's you're not nothing that happens
because then
you
got a great
happy.
Movie.
And then after, it's just him like just pissing it all down. It's like, and listen, that may not happen here. It'd be nice to have faith, but I've been doing this too long. to just put total faith in something I haven't seen. What I can say is this. I've seen Into the Spider-Verse, and it is a brilliant film. I think it's one of the best animated movies of the century. I've seen Across the Spider-Verse, which on its own, or at least in conjunction with Into the Spider-Verse, is also one of the best animated movies of the century. It is absolutely eye-popping, dazzling, inventive, exciting, wonderful character work, exciting concepts and ideas. I love so much about it. But I have to accept that at least until Beyond the Spider-Verse comes out, my positive view has a little asterisk next to it.
Yeah,
that theoretically... my opinion could retroactively change because we're not just seeing another adventure these people are on that may or may not be as good. Like the fact that
that's Fast and Furious.
Like
stuff.
the fact that Quantum of Solace wasn't great didn't really ruin Casino Royale.
Yeah.
Here, and actually, that's not even the best example because they kind of continue some elements. But like a bad Die Another Day.
All
right. Is stupid. It doesn't ruin GoldenEye. GoldenEye is still good.
Yes.
Here, that could happen, and I have to allow for that. But in the interim, until that movie comes out and either blows me away, disappoints me, or makes me shrug and go, meh, we've got an absolutely sensational motion picture right here, and I am determined to enjoy it while I can.
I want everybody to see this movie, by the way. And I want to... All of my qualifications are, like, nitpicks, and I understand that.
Well, this is why we even instituted a rating system in the first place, is because sometimes we'll spend so much time talking about the complexities or the nitpicks or the issues that a movie brings up that we sometimes lose sight of the fact that this overall is a positive review.
I want to say, like, right away, this is an enthusiastic C+ for me. I think people should see this movie.
And if you're new, a C+ is our highest
rating. That's our highest rating.
Yeah.
It is our highest rating, bar none, no question.
Yeah.
My issue is that I'm reviewing one half of a movie.
And that's fair.
And that frustrates me because I understand that they could do something that they've set up or said that will disappoint me.
It's possible.
Maybe they'll pull through with flying colors.
Yeah.
But I feel like we have to take those two movies as a unit,
mm-hmm.
and the second half of the movie isn't done yet.
That's and listen, you know what? That's fair.
Hmm.
But again, this movie is trying to capture in many ways a lot of essences of the comics.
Mm.
And when we used to be able to pick up individual issues more often, yeah. like we would just, and I don't mean like, because we can still do that now if you go to a comic book store, you go to your whatever service you use online. But like, back when comics were not so readily available, and it was basically, there was a spinner rack at your local pharmacy,
mm.
and they got whatever they got. And you didn't know if you picked up an issue of Spider-Man if you were ever going to read the conclusion in the next issue.
Hmm.
That's something that I kind of miss, honestly. There's a certain sort of devil may care kind of quality yeah. to it. Like, you're just diving in the deep end and you don't know if you're going to swim out.
That can
be exciting.
That's a very particular experience. And, yeah. and I had that too. You know, you have to start reading comics somewhere. Of course, exactly. I was in the 90s. I could start with number one whenever I wanted. There are all kinds of number ones.
That's true. Stop bumping the table, please.
Oh, sorry about that. I appreciate that experience, but I feel like Across the Spider-Verse, it isn't necessarily going for that. It's just sort of incidentally shares that quality.
What's the first thing we see on screen?
It's just color.
No, the Comics Code Authority.
Oh, did there's I think
the
I
first
that part.
The first thing on screen? There's like a black screen, and then there used to be a in the corner, it looked like a postage stamp. The Comics Code Authority approved, which means that it had passed muster based on the sort of system of self-censorship, not unlike the Production Code or the Hays Code.
It's kind of gone now.
It is gone now. And it's actually a Dan Slott joke, because when Dan Slott did She-Hulk, and he really focused on the fact that She-Hulk was a lawyer, one of the things that he did, he made it all very meta, and in order to establish precedent for superhero law, which hadn't really been done very well, one of the things you could cite as precedent, because the Comics Code is a government agency.
Mm.
Any issue of a Marvel comic with that code is legal precedent.
Oh, that's funny.
So the specialness of the Comics Code is kind of cool that it's in there, actually. So I think it's just establishing, like, this is a comic book.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
And the executive producers were Phil Lord and Chris Miller.
Yeah, I think they worked on the screenplay, too.
Yeah, they did the original. They also did, you know, some pretty brilliant comedies. Yeah.
New directors this time around, but you wouldn't... That doesn't miss a beat. It doesn't feel like it's a different vibe at all. It's like really exciting.
They also threw in a little joke. In one of their first movies, there was a sound error. Somebody coughed during one of the recording sessions.
Uh-huh.
And they sort of had that during like a rough cut of the movie. And they heard it. Like, there's a little almost inaudible coughing sound just as the studio logo is fading down.
Oh, is that what that was?
And they said, that's kind of cute. Let's just leave it in the movie and see if anyone notices. Nobody did.
Uh-huh.
So, well, we're going to do that with all of our movies. So any Phil Lord, Chris Miller movie, as the studio logo fades down, you're going to hear a little cough.
But in this one, there's actually like in the bottom of the screen, you hear like, you see like written out, like in a combo, cough.
Cough.
I was wondering what that was. It happened so fast that I couldn't pick up
on it. It's a cute little running gag from the
filmmakers.
I didn't
know that. That's amazing. Thank you for that. That's really cool. All right.
We've talked enough about Spider-Man.
We'll stop for now. Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse is not the only major theatrical release this week. We also had a new horror movie based on a short story by Stephen King, who's this obscure... I'm not even going to bother finishing that joke. You know what that joke is. He's a very popular writer, and I was going to downplay that for the purposes of humor. Hmm. I'm done with that now. Stephen King is one of the most best-selling authors of all time. You've probably seen some of the movies based on his work, probably read some of his work.
The movie I'm going to review later, Shooting Stars, makes that joke about LeBron James.
Great.
Like, we heard he did okay. It was one of the jokes about LeBron James.
The Boogeyman is based off of one of his early short stories. I think it was published in 1972, 1973.
73, yeah.
Yeah, and it's a creepy story. Have you ever read it?
No.
The story
As I've said, I've read one Stephen King story and it was it.
All right.
That's my experience.
Well, I know that was it, but like, which one did you read?
My God. Describe The Boogeyman, will you?
The Boogeyman was a short story, and it's quite short, but it's a story about a guy who goes into a therapist's office and explains to him that he's in a harrowing mental state, and his children, multiple children, have died under mysterious circumstances after claiming they were being attacked by the Boogeyman. And in each instance, he would go into the kid's bedroom, they died, and the closet door, which was shut when he left, is now open. So there's a monster in the closet. It's an old, you know, childhood campfire tale, The Boogeyman.
Short story, just what if The Boogeyman was actually killing children?
And there's a couple of twists on it, but that's the basic premise, and we're going to use it through the premise of someone trying to convince a psychologist that I'm not crazy, this is real. That story had, I think it's been a couple of shorts that have been based on it, but it had never been turned into a feature film, which is weird because a lot of people love that one. We got a new one now. It's a feature film directed by Rob Savage, who directed Host, which is one of the best movies of the lockdown wave.
It was a really good movie, yeah.
Excellent found footage horror movie about people performing a seance in the early days of the COVID lockdown. And it turns out one person wasn't taking the safety precautions seriously and potentially doomed them all. Pointed. Nicely done. Genuinely scary, pretty innovative because they had to do it all remotely. A lot of movies tried to do that. Very few of them did it as well as this. It's a really great film. He did a movie last year called Dashcam. Not as good. Grating motion picture.
Dashcam, but yeah.
I did not care for it all. I found it genuinely annoying to watch. So we're in an interesting place where it's like, okay, I've seen one of his movies and it was great. I've seen another one of his movies and I didn't like it. So the third movie is going to be the one that tells me, is he great or is he crap? And it's just okay.
Yeah, it's a little
it's like, damn it, I still don't know.
This is he's proving he can make a studio picture.
Basically, and he can.
Yeah. So he got like a pretty typical studio script, got some, you know, good actors.
Yeah.
I wrote an article about how in order for the actors to get into character, they spent 2 weeks just like going bowling and hanging out.
Yeah, living as a family. It's Chris Messina plays the dad. Mm-hmm. He was the agent in Air earlier this year. Really good actor.
He was hilarious in Air.
Sophie Thatcher
is the
plays the teenage actress, daughter. Yeah. She was recently in The Book of Boba Fett. And then I forget the younger actress's name, but she played the child version of Princess Leia in the TV series Kenobi. So, a bit of a coincidence.
Her name is Vivian Lyra Blair.
All talented people. And they play a family. They're grieving. The mom had very recently died, only within it's like the beginning of the school year. She died over the summer.
Yeah,
and they're all very, very sad.
Her stuff is still in the house. They're all very, it's very, very bleak and very sad. Yeah. And into this sadness comes
the excellent David Dustmalchian.
He's great.
Yeah,
he was Polka Dot Man in the Suicide Squad.
Yeah, he's having a moment. He's like,
he's really good at playing.
Gone from a character actor to guy getting bigger and bigger roles and things.
Yeah, and he plays like kind of really intense roles very well.
Yeah,
he comes to Chris Messina, and Chris Messina is a shrink. And he's trying to continue to work even though he's in mourning, and Sophie Thatcher is also, she's like trying to wear her mom's dress and doesn't get any respect from her friends. Her friends are terrible to her in this movie.
Like your mom died like 2 months ago. Why aren't you over it yet? Yeah. Like, Jesus Christ.
Yeah, you're such a drama queen. It's like, I'm sad.
Yeah.
Fuck off.
Yeah, what a day.
But yeah, Chris Messina sees this like strange guy kind of comes into his office, and this guy says, I've been accused of killing my family, and it's not really me, though, and I need you to know that it's this thing, this monster has appeared, and that was the thing that killed my family. Bye, I'm out of the movie.
Sequence, this is like maybe 10 minutes, probably more like 5, is genuinely harrowing. Like, he's really frightening. Just because he's such a good actor and he's selling it so well.
And Chris Messina doesn't know what to trust. Yeah. Like, I need to go make a phone call, and then something really horrible happens to that guy in their house. So
while Sophie Thatcher is around, and that's very traumatic. So
everything's really horrible. And wouldn't you know it, this seems to have attracted something. That creature he was talking about is a creature that they see barely, kind of peeking through the shadows. That's the Boogeyman.
And now it is in their house, and it is feeding off of their grief and their fear, and it is hiding in the closet, in the corners, and in the dark, and it is after the kids.
What is it? It's the Boogeyman. That's all you need to know.
We're not going to get into its biology or anything like that.
There is some dialogue later in the film because there's some investigation where did it live prior to me? So
where did it come from? It wasn't here before.
See where it's coming from. We see that in a lot of ghost and devil movies, and it's implied, just like in It, that it's like this ancient Lovecraftian deity that's now sort of living among humans. I think it's even older than humanity itself. Yeah. You can just say it's the Boogeyman. I know that.
That's fine. Here's my thing with this movie, and this is the thing that's frustrating, because all the actors are good. The filmmaking is good. It's creepily photographed. Really wonderful editing. There's a lot of good jump scares in it. There's one jump scare in particular that really just had you with me. I was like, ah!
Yeah.
Like, genuinely got me.
There was and there's a tendency of this kind of movie to keep, because it's mostly about the dark, the creature that lives in the dark, to keep things really invisible. You can't see anything. And I've seen too many movies where they film in shadowy locations and you just can't see any damn
thing. No, it's just genuinely hard to look at. And here, it's controlled.
Rob Savage and his cinematographer, let me look up the cinematographer, know how to light these scenes and film them. So there's like little...
There's darkness, but it's not...
Glimpses of the monster.
You're not looking into a void.
Eli Bourne is the name of the cinematographer.
You're not looking into a void. Your gaze is being controlled.
Yeah.
And that's what you would see in maybe like the early films of like Owen Roisman. Mm-hmm. Like, this is how you do inky cinematography. It's not just not lighting it. It's making sure only the most important things have any light on them whatsoever. As a PG-13 jump scare fest, it's okay. The problem is that it's a PG-13 jump scare fest, and I don't mean to write that off as a genre. What I mean is that that is currently being kind of done to death. There is a whole genre, I don't think it has a name, I've been calling them griefer movies, where the monster of the movie is a literal monster, but it is the physical personification of the protagonist's psychological turmoil, whether that's grief or fear or their like sexual baggage and It Follows.
Grief and trauma are becoming, have long been for like maybe the last 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe something 9/11. A really, really common theme in a lot of horror movies.
Well, and it's always been something that horror has dealt with, but I think in the last 20, 30 years or so, as we've become more... psychology has been less stigmatized, and we talk about these things more openly, and more people are familiar with some of the actual terminology that we use, characters in movies are more articulate about it. I think that's reasonable. I think we just have to adapt with that. The problem with these kinds of movies, and there's a lot of great ones... Like, The Babadook is a classic. It's fantastic. It's a modern horror classic. I would say the same for It Follows. And there's a lot of versions that are, like, I think Smile is absolutely astounding. It scared the pants off of me. And there are other ones that are really good but don't quite nail it, like David S. Sandberg's Lights Out, which has a lot of creepy bits in it, but really whiffs the ending, and I'll explain why in a second. The problem with these movies is that the audience is made painfully aware that the monster isn't a guy in a costume. It is a representation of psychology.
Yeah.
And as such, it cannot be beaten to death with a baseball bat. You cannot electrocute it in a swimming pool. That doesn't actually do anything. And as a result, it defies not just horror filmmaking, but basic principles of filmmaking that a lot of filmmakers rely on. The idea that there must be, towards the end of the movie, escalating action.
And
not just tension, action.
Well, and escalating action, a confrontation, a climax of some kind. Yeah. It doesn't have to be, you know, electrocuted in a pool.
No, but usually a physical showdown of one kind or another. And the thing is that... simply killing the monster doesn't kill the monster because the monster's in your head.
Yeah,
so these movies have to end with either the monster winning and someone overcome by their emotional turmoil.
Yeah.
Them overcoming the emotional turmoil, which will usually basically take the form of we're in therapy now, or learning to live with it.
Yeah, which was part of the Babadook.
Exactly.
I feel like a skilled filmmaker can do one of those things. And even if it's like, I'm going to face off the monster, I'm going to set it on fire, but then, you know, there's usually little symbolic indicators. They walk outside and now it's sunny out. And, you know, there's a little bit of a flash forward, a little bit of an epilogue, and there's more, like, light and joy in the house.
Nightmare on Elm Street has an ending that's a lot like that, where it seems like we have physically defeated Freddy Krueger, but the actual ending of the movie points out, no, he's in your subconscious.
Yeah.
That's always there.
Nightmare on Elm Street is like kind of a double back. It's like, okay, you didn't defeat the monster.
But the problem is that when your movie is so literal, and when you just try to make it about the physical manifestation of the monster and the physical threat that it poses, a movie like The Boogeyman, which runs out of ideas pretty early...
It doesn't have a lot of ideas. No, it's not terribly sophisticated.
It literally just, it's pretty cool when it's following the short story, but that's over by about 10 minutes into the movie. And now what we are left with is, frankly, an underwhelming rehash of Lights Out, which also had a lot of gags in which the monster is only visible when it's dark. When the lights are on, it vanishes.
I think the movie is incredibly capable. Mm-hmm. I think the performances are good, and I love the photography. I think the monster is scary enough. It made me jump a couple of times.
There's a couple of gross bits with the monster.
It's almost like a baseline reading of how these things ought to
go. Exactly. It doesn't add anything new
in any kind of way.
Exactly. It's just okay. It doesn't do anything terribly wrong. But it also is just sort of a textbook example of just how generic this particular subgenre, the griefer subgenre, has gotten. And that, for horror, arguably worse than bad, because that means it's not having an impact. And that is scary, because that means that this may be, we've reached a point where a saturation point. Where this particular approach has become kind of familiar. It's just familiar. And like, maybe we need a little break. Maybe we need someone to just inject some new vitality into it. Maybe in a week or a month or whatever, we'll see another movie does something very, very similar, but does it in a different way. And all of a sudden, it feels fresh and exciting again. That's totally possible.
Or there's other ideas we need to start exploring with horror.
Also, that's true. I'm just saying, like, but I don't think that... We have a tendency sometimes, because horror tends to move in waves, and there's certain things that become popular, subgenres that become popular. They're incredibly popular, everyone loves them, and then sometimes there's a tendency to just throw them away. Everyone is making found footage horror movies. Now we've pretty much thrown them away. They don't really come out in theaters anymore, you know? Nothing really wrong with the found footage horror genre, it's just they made so many of them that it no longer felt new and exciting. Even the ones that were actually pretty good. And it just needed to simmer down a little bit, you know, wait to be goosed. So, The Boogeyman is just baseline, mediocre monster in the closet movie.
Yeah.
There are better versions. Lights Out is a better version, except for the ending of Lights Out, which is profoundly irresponsible. It is just genuinely a gross way to end a movie about mental illness, and I do not care for it, because it argues that the solution to the problem... If the solution to the problem in Lights Out that the movie presents to us is what the movie actually thinks, then the real-world analog of that is repellent. What they're offering is just gross. And I think that movie desperately needs a sequel to take the edge off of that and try to sweep that up. But anyway... Regardless, this has been done better. It will be done better, I'm sure. This is just okay.
I think this almost feels like another audition piece for Rob Savage, the director. It feels like I can make a bigger production, and I wouldn't be surprised to see him tackle something even larger next time.
Sure, I'd give him another project. Like, I don't think it's bad. I just think the material
I think this is competent, which, you know, is almost like damning with faint praise.
Yeah.
But I was still so moved by Host that I feel like he actually has a voice as well. So we'll see how he continues to make movies if he does.
I'm hoping he has better material next time. Yeah, maybe that's what it boils down to. All right, we got two more movies. I didn't see them. You did.
Okay.
Then one of them is a horror thriller, I believe, called Follow Her.
Yes, it's called Follow Her. You were talking about last week. What was it? Was it just called Influencer?
On Shudder. Yeah.
There's a lot of movies coming out in the next couple of years about influencers. Right. There was a movie I saw earlier this year called Slayers, which was about influencers and how they're being influenced, or they're being recruited by vampires to sort of sell the vampire brand on social media.
Like, that's an
element of the movie.
That's a fun idea.
And Thomas Jane is it as like the grizzled old Van Helsing type of a character. I liked Slayers a lot. I think that's really fun.
Cool.
Follow Her is also about... that divide between what we're selling online and who we are in real life. Mm-hmm. There's a lot going on in Follow Her. So it's about an internet model and cam girl, sex worker, played by Danny Barker, who's also the film's screenwriter.
Mm-hmm.
And she... And this movie has a lot of double backs, because it starts out with her sort of in this weird torture scenario. And she's like torturing this guy who's, I think he's locked in a freezer. And he's like, I'm never going to let you out of here. I'm going to torture you. And after a while, he starts saying, yes, please. Oh. And we realize, oh, wait, this is a fetish video. He's hired her to do this. This is sexy times for him.
Enjoying this, yeah.
And, but his face is blurred out. We don't see his face. And then we pull back. Big reveal. Then we pull back another layer. It turns out she kept that video, and she's been posting it online to these sort of this cadre of filmmakers as this kind of cinema verite. Here's the weirdos I have to deal with.
Okay.
But their faces are all blurred out, so it's okay. She's not violating their trust.
Yeah.
Until she makes another one of these videos. The censorship blur doesn't work for a minute, so people can see his face.
Oh, no.
But it's really good.
Oh, no.
And there's that moment where her finger's like hovering over the mouse button, and wouldn't you know, she publishes it.
Why don't you just take a minute and blur that thing out?
It's one of the... there were circumstances. Like, she had to do it at like that moment. Or just like, she posted it, didn't realize it, and then left it up.
Okay.
She is then, shortly thereafter, the next day, hired by somebody to come out to a very remote cabin, place where the cell phones don't work.
Oh, those.
And help her finish a screenplay he's been working on, which is really Hitchcockian, about people who are locked in a cabin together. Wouldn't you know it? And there's also this weird sort of sexual element. He's constantly flirting with her, and she, in order to keep her, you can tell she's doing it to keep herself kind of safe. It's like trying to flirt back in a way that's sort of keeping at arm's distance.
Yeah, I'm not being rude to you, but no, thank you.
She's like, she feels like she's in danger. You can tell she feels like she's in danger. So she's sort of trapped against a wall. And there's an element where her friend was supposed to be there and her friend couldn't make it. So she's alone.
Yeah.
And over the course of the movie, we begin to find that the screenplay he's writing are things that happened to her in real life that he couldn't possibly know about. And now it turns out he's trying to turn the tables on her about the kind of film they're making. And is he trying to expose her and the irresponsibility she had for exposing that guy? What does it say about the secrets we have and how they're leaking online? There's actually a lot of rich stuff in this movie.
Well, is it alluded to, or is it actually... Because there's a lot of what you're saying could be done... Hmm. Uncleverly. It could be blunt and could be annoying.
It actually is blunt, but it's not annoying. Okay. I feel they actually have these very...
Subtlety is not inherently a virtue. No, that doesn't bother me at all.
There's this... the whole show don't tell rule of filmmaking. Mm-hmm. That's something you tell first year film students so they're encouraged to think of things visually. How can you communicate things just in a visual way?
It's also something that the American government came up with.
Indeed it is, because if you show and don't tell, you can't talk about politics, can you?
Exactly. They wanted to actually make sure that less politics was leaking into the media that people was consuming. So they would say, like, not only do we not think you should actually discuss the issues that affect people in real life, we're going to encourage academia to say that engaging with real life issues is bad writing.
Yeah.
That's one of the most insidious things. And that's true. You can look that up. Weird shit.
I love a talky movie, by the way. I love movies where people just sort of discuss it. And maybe that's one of my issues with Spider-Man. It's like, I want them to just sit and have a conversation. I don't need all this action.
They do that too.
They do that as well.
Yeah.
In this one, follow her.
Yeah.
They actually do have a discussion about the nature of privacy and what she thinks she was doing with her channel and what he thinks she was doing with her channel and how there's a moral element to what they're doing. Mm. And how much do we expect our lives to be private when we're constantly making them public? What is our character online as opposed to our character in person? That movie We're All Going to the World's Fair deals with this as well.
Who are we
online versus who are we in person? How much are those things separate? How much of it is a game and how much of it is actual, you know, us exploring our identity? We're alone on the internet this generation.
We're alone in a crowded room.
I love We're All Going to the World's Fair so much.
It's one of the best movies of the decade. Was my favorite best movie last year?
It was on my top 10.
It was one of the few movies we agreed on. Like, our top 10s were very different last year, and I was very surprised.
Oh.
I didn't remember you even seeing that movie.
I reviewed it. We're All Going to the World's Fair is really excellent. And this isn't nearly as revolutionary or as deep as all that. It's actually, like I said, very blunt. But I do like sort of the ideas it comes up with. It's pretty good. It's better than The Boogeyman, because there's engaging with some ideas. Yeah, and the main, let me look up the actor who plays like the guy that she's writing the screenplay
with. Is it scary?
It's more uncomfortable, because this guy's like kind of creeping around, and you realize she's in danger after a while, and you know, it becomes pretty harrowing and a little bit more violent after that. The director is named Sylvia Kaminer. I think this is her first feature.
Okay.
She's really, really good because she's clearly looking at this from a woman online who has to meet a man. And how just what a harrowing experience that is. So there's a lot of themes of this movie about how merely being a woman on the internet can make you a target as well.
Sure.
So there's a gender imbalance that this film is also kind of addressing. Luke Cook is the name of the actor. He played Satan on the new Sabrina series.
Oh, I didn't see that. I heard that was good, but I never got around to it. Yeah.
So yeah, I dig this one. It played at a festival, and it's only just now kind of coming out in sort of smaller release. But yeah, it's an interesting one.
Good to know.
Interesting one. I think worth a seek.
All right, and then our last film is a bit of an about face. It is a biopic.
It's a biopic.
It's a biopic about a basketball player you may or may not have heard of. Mm-hmm. Whitney, tell us about this basketball player.
His name is LeBron James.
Ah, yes. I remember him from the movie House Party.
We have a movie about LeBron James, a fictionalized version about LeBron James, and we also had a fictionalized version of Michael Jordan, which means we're really exploring the Space Jam universe.
Oh my God,
really,
you're right.
Well, yeah.
We had Air, and now we have Shooting Stars.
Now we have Shooting Stars. Whoa. So yeah, kind of weird that we're coming around on the Space Jam basketball
Bugs
players.
Bunny should have been a character in Air.
Wouldn't that have been keen?
No, just in the periphery. Like, this will be important later. This is going to happen.
Space Jam in the movie.
Maybe one of those big montages, but I don't think so.
But Shooting Stars is actually about LeBron James as a teenager. I think he was 15 during the course of this movie. It takes place in the mid-90s. And it's about him and, let's see, their names are Drew Joyce, Keith Dambrot, and I think Romeo Travis. He and four of his buddies did nothing but play basketball when they were teenagers, when they were in high school. They played basketball before school. They went to school and they played basketball. They trained after school at basketball. Then they went home to sort of relax and hang out and be friends together, and they would play basketball. And then it was time for bed. They'd play video games, and it was basketball video games. They did nothing but basketball.
Okay. Paid off.
For LeBron James, certainly.
Yeah.
And all of these other guys, they never made it to the majors, but they played like in international teams, or they coached teams. Like, they actually had successful basketball careers as well.
Okay.
They just didn't become gigantic stars like LeBron James.
Because, well, very few human beings.
I was about to say, he's
high bar.
But it turns out, you know, these guys were very important to the development of LeBron James and his obsession with basketball, because it was mutual.
Yeah.
It's more about these five kids rather than just him doing, you know, being the one maverick.
Right.
Dermot Mulroney plays one of the coaches that sort of looks after them. He's really sort of tough.
Very reliable actor, Dermot Mulroney. Never phones it in. Yeah.
He and another one of the coaches talk about just coaching basketball games, and they do coach basketball games, and there's a lot of basketball. There's no sense of like rising action or drama. They just sort of play basketball games. This is another game.
Mm-hmm.
They win it. They're very happy about it.
Mm-hmm.
They go to this one. You might make it to the big league someday, LeBron James. These other guys might not be as good. You got in a little bit of trouble. Now you're on the cover of Sports Illustrated, but you got in a little bit of trouble for not like a crime. It was like some sort of contractual thing, and now you can't play. And so he begs, I want to play some games. Not because I want to win. I just want to play games with my friends because we're about to graduate high school.
Right.
And they do that. And that's the movie. This is what you call a hangout movie.
Okay.
And
those can be good.
And I like a good hangout movie where it's not really about the story. It's about the conversations that characters have when they're hanging out.
It's what it's like to be in the room with them when it isn't life or death.
Yeah.
Which is something film can do. And it's really valuable, actually, to get that sense of to be a fly on the wall.
And that's something I like about a lot of Richard Linklater's movies.
Yeah.
A lot of his movies are just about conversation.
Yeah.
The Before movies are all about conversation. Waking Life, it's an animated film, but it's also just about conversation.
Dazed and Confused.
A lot of people just sort of hanging out and talking. And
it can feel really important, but it's really important because that's just what life is.
Yeah. And those kinds of movies have a little bit of texture to them. We get to know about their characters. We get to know about sort of their lives and who they are. We don't get that in this movie. There's no texture to this movie. It's directed by a guy named Chris Robinson, who does a lot of TV. Mm-hmm. And
well, he's done a lot of music videos. He did a movie called ATL, and a movie called Beats. I didn't see ATL or Beats.
I heard ATL was okay. I remember getting mixed reviews.
Yeah.
He has no sense of sort of dramatic tone, and he has no sense of like pacing. It's just this is what LeBron James was like as a teenager. Isn't that neat?
Here's
like, well, yes, LeBron James was a teenager once. I knew he didn't spring fully formed from the head of Zeus. He was born and raised.
Here's the thing that upsets me, because here's the I don't know very much about sports.
Okay.
And if you knew me, you would know how comical an understatement that is. I had to have someone explain who LeBron James was to me not that long ago. Like within the last couple of years.
He's kind of like the biggest basketball star in the world right now.
I get it now. I just don't follow it. It's not my thing. I have respect for everyone who does it. Everyone who does it at that level. Everyone who just puts in the effort. Tons of respect. I don't follow it. I don't know. I think that's a flaw. That's a huge part of culture that I do not know about, and I'm actually admitting and to. I'm not bragging about this. It's a flaw. But what I do know about LeBron James is that at some point when he was young, I assume when he was in college, maybe when he was in high school, an older version of LeBron James visited him from the future thanks to the power of cryptocurrency and told him that he's going to be a big deal and assured him, this early version of himself, and I didn't know this, but a young LeBron James looked a lot like a CGI character, assured him that he was ready.
That scene's not in this movie.
What the fuck are we even here for? That's the most interesting thing that ever happened to him before he became a big deal in basketball. Yeah. Come on. That was a commercial, by the way. It was everywhere.
You're going to be a big star. You couldn't hide
it. Yeah, it was a weird commercial for cryptocurrency. Because if you buy a cryptocurrency, maybe you'll be LeBron James getting out of the ground floor. And it's like...
The word I want to use is, and this is one you see in criticism a lot, it's a hagiography.
Okay. Is it a hard G? I always thought it was a hagiography.
I've heard it both ways, actually, so I'm never really sure.
Let's see if I can look that up. That's worth knowing.
Is it hagiography or hagiography? Yeah. I heard it on Jeopardy the other night, and they said hagiography, so maybe they got it wrong.
Which actually comes from the Greek for a biopic of a saint. Yeah, a religious leader, very positive.
So it's very positive. It's not sort of a warts and all. It's not about his struggles. They don't try to sandwich in some kind of drama. The big drama was he just wants to hang out with his friends. Yeah. And that can be really great.
It looks like it's a hard cheat. It's hagiography.
Hagiography, yeah.
Okay. Right. From Graphy and hagios is holy.
Hagios, sorry. It's very positive about LeBron James, and it has all those chyrons at the end, and like I said, it makes that joke. And here are his other five friends. They went on to these prestigious basketball careers. This guy coached. Mm-hmm. This guy played overseas. And this is LeBron James. We heard he did okay. Isn't that cute?
Isn't that adorable?
That's all we have with this movie. Shooting.
Because you're probably not going to question him too hard at this point.
No,
you know?
I'm trying to think, like, I've seen a movie that kind of just did that. It was just really positive about a character before and didn't really have a drama.
Like, that wasn't a biopic?
That was or wasn't a biopic.
Well, I mean, I've seen...
I've seen something like that before. I just can't call it to mind right now.
Oh, my God. I'm just whiffing in all these, like, terrible biopics.
If you love LeBron James... Mm-hmm. Sure, watch this movie. This is a fun way, like a fun fictionalized version of his youth, where these actors are playing the young versions of LeBron James and his buddies.
Yeah.
If you don't know LeBron James, it's going to be real boring to you. It's not a good introduction to who LeBron James is. Maybe just watch his games.
There you go.
Watch him play. Watch the new Space Jam if you have to. I don't recommend that, but...
Do you have to, really?
It's a rotten movie.
The Fablemans.
Oh, there you go.
That's a hagiography.
Yeah.
That's not...
And he's doing it to himself in that movie.
Yeah, that one's weird. Everyone's just sort of fine with that.
I wasn't so fond of the Fablemans.
No, I wasn't either. But that's definitely a good example right there. I'm trying to think of anything else. Anyway, it's relevant. Yeah, I didn't see it, so I'll just take
a look at
that.
So it's, ultimately kind of a boring flick.
There you go.
You just watch these kids play basketball.
All right.
And they're still doing it.
Good for them. Well, that's it for...
Proud of all of them in life.
Yeah.
Just don't need to see this movie.
That's fine. Just because not everything is a movie. Mm. Or at least not everything is necessarily easily transformed into a movie. So... Anyway, that is it for Critically Acclaimed. We're going to review our movies on a scale of C- to C+. C- is below average. It's the worst review we can give a movie. It is something we do not recommend. We think it is below average. A C is average. You know, some pros, some cons. More for one audience than another. Most movies hover around average. And then there's C+, which is above average. The highest rating we can give. We think these movies are definitely worth seeing. We might even think they're brilliant. On that note, Whitney, Shooting Stars.
C-. Not a passionate C-, but just kind of a dull, nothing, kind of a puffball movie.
All right. Follow Her.
A very high C.
Okay.
It could, I'm not super passionate about the movie, but I thought it intriguing. I thought it was very interesting.
Well crafted. The Boogeyman.
That is a middle of the road C.
This is a definition of a C.
This is a 5 out of 10, right up the middle.
If it was a short film that was just the David Dastmalchian parts, might have been a C+.
Yeah.
But it's not. It keeps going and it just becomes a very generic version of Monster in the Closet, and it represents my fears. I've seen it done a lot better.
Yeah.
But I've seen it done a lot worse. So competent, middle of the road. If this is, like, you're taking your kid to see their very first horror movie and you don't want it to be, like, to mess them up forever while still actually giving them something scary, it might not be a bad idea. Be a good slumber party movie down the road, maybe.
Maybe so.
And then, finally, total C. And then, finally, Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse, which, of course, you spent so much time saying was terrible.
That unapologetic C+. Very high C+, if I can even do that. I was exhilarated watching it. My issues about it being a half of a movie will only last until I see the second half.
And this is my point as well. I think those points are well taken, but they're temporary.
Yeah.
And eventually we'll open that Schrodinger's box and we'll find out if Beyond the Spider-Verse addresses issues, makes things retroactively better, worse, same.
If the cat is alive... We're good.
If Beyond the Spider-Verse is as good as Across the Spider-Verse, this is going to be
We're good. Yeah.
Maybe the new greatest trilogy ever made. Like, it's just that astounding. This is a gigantic C+. This is, like, if you were, like, worried about superhero movies, like, is there any gas left in the tank? There's so much gas. And they just set it on fire and it exploded in this movie.
I think, and this is something I should have mentioned earlier. We've been stuck a little too long on what Batman Begins started.
Yeah.
Christopher Nolan introduced this notion of realism.
Yeah. What if Batman was real? What would that look like?
And even the Avengers movies, the MCU, has kind of taken that approach, even as they've gone to, like, wilder and wilder places, which is why they've always had those cute gags, like, oh, this is really extraordinary.
Yeah, isn't it funny that we use our superhero names?
You just cut a bus in half.
When Marvel does it feels like they're a little bit ashamed to be superhero movies, which is kind of weird.
They're trying to keep, like, a lot on the ground.
One toe in reality.
Yeah, and when you're reading a comic book, those are drawings on pages.
Yeah.
You don't need that one toe in reality. You can be as wild as you want.
I got reality and at home. I don't come to your superhero movie.
Trying to replicate
that.
Like a Jim Starlin spacescape in like realistic CGI isn't the way to do that.
No, go nuts.
And Across the Spider-Verse, finally, thank fuck, goes nuts. Like, just do it.
To be fair, Into the Spider-Verse did it as well, but we need more of this, and I want more of the live-action movies to acknowledge this as well.
Yeah, there's a Ninja Turtles movie coming up.
Yeah.
It looks astonishingly good.
Visually, at least. Visually, we only see the trailer, but it looks exciting.
Visually, it looks really great. The design is really wild. It looks like it's painterly. It's like
Puss in Boots: The Last Wish was like this as well.
A few of the fight scenes were really great.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Like, it's exciting to me, and again, it's weird because, again, Into the Spider-Verse financially, unless you count like the ones that were barely released overseas, like we talked about at the beginning, financially, it's the least successful Spider-Man movie we ever had. Mm-hmm. Even the ones that were considered box office bombs, like Amazing Spider-Man 2, made about twice as much as Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. And yet, It was so good. It threw down a gauntlet that was, and honestly, it was such a heavy gauntlet, it's taken almost 5 years for other filmmakers to pick it up.
Yeah.
And we're starting to see it now. We're starting to see that influence come. That's how we got No Way Home. Mm. You know, No Way Home is a live action version of that, and it's quite good. I like
the moral of that more than I like the actual filmmaking, but yeah.
I think it works. But regardless, in terms of not just great storytelling, but great filmmaking, great animation, pushing what animation can be, taking away this formalistic attitude that it has to like look like it's in the real world, or that it has some sort of solid reality within it. No, this is pure expressionism, and it is beautiful. It is a huge C+. It's already one of the best movies I've seen this year, and I've seen some really good movies this year. It's been a solid year for film. All right, that is it for Critically Acclaimed. We'll be back next time with a new Transformers movie about giant robots who came to Earth and decided to disguise themselves as giant robot gorillas.
Good disguise.
I'm not sure who they fooled with that.
Good disguise, bro.
Interesting choice.
Oh, that's not a robot from another planet. That's just a giant robot gorilla.
Yeah.
Like you see.
Like you do. But we got that coming up and a few other things as well. And we will review the living hell out of them on the next Critically Acclaimed. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Thank you, everybody, for following us. Please subscribe if you haven't already. Mm. If you haven't left us a review, a star rating, a sentence, anything at all, that really helps us a lot. You just taking 30 seconds out of your day to do that really helps us jump the algorithm and find more audiences. So if you haven't done that, please do. And if you really want to support the show even more, you can head on over to our Patreon page, patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. And if you have the means and you want to subscribe, you can get a lot of exclusive material from us on the Patreon page, including ongoing regular podcasts, like Only the Best, where we review every single movie ever nominated for Best Picture. Only the Best International, where we're reviewing every single movie ever nominated for Best International Picture. All Our Yesterdays, we're reviewing every single episode of Star Trek in order. We do commentary tracks. We do Discord hangouts. We have our new show, Thank Godzilla, It's Friday, airs every Friday on this channel. You can subscribe for free. Or you can get the episodes 1 week early by subscribing at any tier, even $1 a month, on our Patreon page. And if you're a subscriber on Patreon, you can listen to all of our new episodes without ads, which is a bonus. So, anyway, thank you to all of our patrons. It means the world to us that you've joined us and that you support the show. It allows us to keep doing the show. If you can afford to join, great. And if not, thank you for listening. You're wonderful. Have a great time. Have a great week. If you want to talk about anything we discussed in this episode, do you disagree with us about Spider-Man, the Boogeyman, that one cryptocurrency commercial, feel free to email us. Our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. We might read your email on an upcoming episode of We've Got Mail and respond to your questions, concerns, critiques, whatever they are. We also have a P.O. box. If you prefer to write in the old-fashioned way, we love it when you do. Whitney, what is our P.O. box?
Send us an actual physical letter. Send it to this Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. Box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
Yep. And we're on Twitter, @CriticAcclaim. I'm @WilliamBibiani.
I'm @WhitneySeibold.
And never forget, everyone, including you, is a critic.
I want to go to the midnight show. I'm sorry, what?